if I can't beat Mark any other way, I'll have more audiovisual aids than he will. I'm honored to be with you this evening. I'm humbled for multiple reasons, esteem issues aside. I always, whenever I see the individuals that I'm on the program with, I always feel that I'm in wonderful company, and it's borne itself out so far today. And I just really appreciate the opportunity to be able to share with you all tonight. Till death do we part. As if any of us could be truly experts on marriage. I, like Dwayne, wondered, why did I get this one? And I was struck by the irony that some 22 years ago at this meeting, I first saw my wife. And I know that I comment about that occasionally as it is, but this place for the brethren as well as for other reasons holds special things for me. It is interesting whenever we talk about marriage or marriage experts in general. It's interesting how many of the experts have been married multiple times. It's interesting how many aren't married now of marriage and relationship experts in the media and the like. I think it's truly an impossibility for anyone to be a marriage expert apart from Jesus, apart from God, because it's not about me. That's part of the issue, is that it's not about me. It's a team effort. And if I was paired with someone else, it would be a different experience altogether. And so it's important for us to realize whenever we're in this thing called marriage or we're contemplating this thing called marriage, that it is till death do we part. There are multiple reasons for that, and we'll address some of those. But it's a team effort of husband and wife. And you can't do it alone. That's one of the main reasons why it's important to have a believing spouse, because at least you know what you're supposed to be starting with. At least you know then you know where you're supposed to be starting from. Is that if you love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, at least you'll do it for God, won't you? And that's where we sometimes are brought to. And we'll talk about that when we talk about the two types of love as well. I've been asked to address some factors contributing to the decline in the marriage commitment. And I think that we're talking about the broad scope, but then also among the churches. Our congregation has begun experiencing issues with divorce, legal separation, and the like. And I think that it's probably the same for most of the rest of us here. One of the main reasons is that people are tired of living in a loveless marriage. And used to be, you've basically got three options if you're in a loveless marriage. Number one, you can throw in the towel. And the reason why we're seeing more and more divorce, and we're seeing divorce not just in those that have been married on the average of 7 years, but we're seeing divorces of individuals that have been in marriage for 25, 30 years, throwing in the towel now. Why? Because the social inhibition no longer exists to keep that from happening now. That's one of the reasons why we're starting to see that happen in society. And so that's one of the options. You can just throw in the towel and just be done with it and take your broken self on down to the next relationship. and attach your broken self to that relationship and see how it goes. The second is to just put up with it, which in times past, I thank God for the marriages that last 50 years and what have you, but I've seen examples where individuals have been married 50 years and it's been drudgery. It's just been lugging along, and we're doing this thing, and I praise God through Jesus that they do it because it's a testimony before man that they have a duty that they have to uphold. But God has designed marriage to be so much more than that. So the third option is to fix it, to fix the situation and fix the issue. And God has given us plentiful material by which we can look to be able to fix those types of issues in our lives. Another reason is the popular culture likes the idea of intimate partnerships, and I'm going to put that in air quotes, intimate partnerships, but finds them inconvenient in pursuing a lifestyle of self-actualization and personal fulfillment. It'd be okay for me to tie myself to someone if it didn't bring me down, if it didn't somehow get in the way of the lifestyle that I'd like to live. We're seeing more and more of those types of issues arising where we aren't fulfilled anymore. You know, he's just not the one that he's just not the guy that I married. She's just not the lady that I came to fall in love with. Often this is manifested in aberrant sexual pursuits. And again, as far as the media, as far as the modern entertainment, it's interesting. Britney Spears had a song that came out a couple years ago now, I think, and the title of it's 1-2-3. And I wish it was just an ABC 1-2-3 kind of song, but actually it's menage a trois. It's involving more individuals in an escapade than is mandated in Scripture. And then the kicker is in the chorus, she says, and four on the floor. You know, where it's just this progression. Then strangely enough, one of her subsequent releases is Womanizer, where she's berating and rebuking her man for being a womanizer. I don't get it. You get this whipsaw where, you know, we think we like this one thing, but then whenever we start to see and experience the consequences of it, we don't like that so well. But in our brokenness, it's very difficult sometimes for individuals if they don't have a belief, if they don't have faith in Jesus Christ, it's hard to get off that merry-go-round. It's very, very hard to get off that merry-go-round, I believe it. Popular now, however, in modern culture. I don't know if any of you have heard one of Train's latest ones, Marry Me. Lovely song. It talks about the, a relationship between a man and a woman. And all throughout, you know, if he can just get the nerve up to ask her out. But you see the relationship actually progress. And you know in the end of the song that they have gotten married and that the relationship's been developed. And in answer to that, I haven't been able to identify the female artist yet. But the song is You Make Me Say... You make me want to say I do. In which case she sings about the things that the gentleman does to make her want to be married to him. Both good songs. But the thing is that you see in our culture this conflict. As far as we think that marriage is a good idea or what some equate marriage to be, but we still have a hard time letting go of what we want, me. A third factor I think that has contributed to the decline in marriage commitment is technology. Technology facilitates any activity, whether it be sinful or otherwise. And I've got an article here from the Christian Examiner that I ran off before our computer contracted a virus earlier in the month. And this is what it says, and we're quoting Thomas White, Vice President for Student Services and Communications at Southwest Baptist Theological Seminary in Fort Worth, Texas, be that whatever it is, said, unhealthy marriages, unguarded partners, and fallen humanity, not technology. And I'll grant him this. Unhealthy marriages, unguarded partners, and fallen humanity, not technology, are the problem. White, who is also an associate professor of theology, offered four tips for spouses who are on Facebook. 1, give your spouse the password and the freedom to check your Facebook at any time. 2, disable Facebook's chat function. It provides a way to communicate without any record and can lead to a false sense of safety, White said. 3. Set all Facebook messages to forward to someone else's email address who can serve as an accountability partner. An additional layer of accountability, White said, would be to have the messages forwarded to your spouse's email. White said his messages are forwarded to his work email, which his assistants view. And 4, don't accept a past romantic interest friend request or send a request until discussing it with your spouse. Facebook is not evil, but as with all forms of technology, we have to be wise in how we use them, White said. Ease of communication has opened the doors to all sorts of possibilities, good and bad, White and Martin said. Prior to the internet and Facebook, a person would have had to spend days, weeks, or even months to try and find someone they knew years ago. An out-of-the-blue phone call would have been a much bolder action. And this is part of it, too, this desensitization of, oh, well, it's just Facebooking. Oh, we're just chit-chatting. Oh, we're just reminiscing. That's a potential problem. And if you can't discuss that or share that with your spouse, that's a real problem that you need to address straight up right away. Because there are individuals among congregations, there are individuals that are of within the family's personal acquaintance where people are leaving their spouses for virtual relationships that they've developed online. And one of the things that they go on to say further is that, as for all intents and purposes, these are real relationships. This is infidelity. This isn't until death do we part. In addition, and to speak to our personal accountability, I guess I may be just too young to know that Ray Charles had a substance abuse issue, but Ray Charles did, and he may have struggles even so. But this is an interesting quote from Ray Charles concerning that. He said, I did it to myself. It wasn't society. It wasn't a pusher. It wasn't being blind or being black or being poor. It was all my doing. And at the end of the day, whatever we do in regards to our marriage relationships, as we seek to get into them or as we are living within, we have to ask ourselves, as far as what we are doing, what is this going to cost me? Am I doing something that is going to cost me at all? And further, the spiritual question is begged. You know, what did it cost to get you out of the messes that we so oftentimes get ourselves into? Or we allow our sinful natures to lead us into them. Well, we can't reverse the trend in society, but I think we can do better in our homes and our congregations if we, each of us, take responsibility. Can we do better at educating our young people? Yes. Can we do better at educating ourselves? Yes. But we must be engaged and we must stay engaged. And we've got to understand and act on some elemental principles. And that's what I've put up on the board here. Starting at the top here, marriage. What is it? We've got to understand what marriage is to begin with. Visual number one, and I've done this before, so if you've seen me do this, forgive me. Dan Green did this at Vandalia quite a few years ago, and it really made an impact on me. We've got two popsicle sticks, all right? This is husband and wife, however you care to, you know, reference the husband having the tape on him already. I don't know. All right? But our concept, generally speaking, people's concept of marriage is that we're going to join together and we're going to bind this together. You know, I pre-wrapped the tape, gone in and out a couple times. And so now we're together, all right? We're together. This is a legal bond, all right? Until such a time, and this is in the consciousness of society, in Western society, until such a time we find it inconvenient, at which point then we can somehow wriggle and wiggle our way out of it, and we're two people again. Well, that's plainly not the way it works. Because man didn't create marriage. God created marriage. God designed marriage to go together in a certain way. And in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24, where it says that a man shall leave his father and mother and do what with his wife? Cleave to his wife. That word cleave in the Hebrew, as I understand it, and it has been explained to me, and I've heard it discussed, is a cementing, is a gluing. It's not a taping. It's not a some other way trying to get together. And it's not us doing it. Matthew chapter 19 and verse 4, this is Jesus' own testimony. Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female and said, for this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife and the two shall become one flesh. Consequently, they are no longer two, but one. What therefore God has joined together, let not man put asunder. You don't get out of this without there being collateral damage. You don't get out of this without there being additional brokenness to you. You'll have more lackings. You'll have more baggage. You will never be the same person that you were before that relationship. That's something that we really have to take seriously. We really have to take this to heart. Cleaving is a cementing. God does it. We don't undo it by going through the court system. We don't try to assuage ourselves with, oh, the kids will get over it. The kids are resilient. And then you take this brokenness and you put it on this brokenness, and pretty soon you've got yourself a real mess. A real mess. We've got to perceive this relationship the way God designed the relationship to be perceived. We have to act out in this relationship the way God designed this relationship to be acted out in. Let's talk about the two types of love. The two types of love. Anybody know what I'm going to say? What's that? Okay. In a way. What are the two Greeks that we have for agape? If I can spell it. Okay, what's the agape?
Sacrificial love.
That's duty love. And the phileo? Friendship, fondness. I'm going to call that affection. I told Charles I was going to do it, so I better do it. There's a book that I would recommend that you all read. The Bible is our textbook for all relationships. There's a book out there entitled The Five Love Languages. And if you'd like kind of a preview before you actually buy it, Rick Sparks actually gave a two-segmented lesson that's on the Smart Road website that he gave back in 2004. And in the giving of the lesson, he actually recommended it as well. And then he gave the scriptural touchstones as he went through talking about that book. He actually had it recommended to him. And I would recommend it as well, where it's not just good for marriage relationship, although it's very good as far as just general knowledge, being able to relate to one another and know how we understand love gestures. But there's all sorts of good information in there. One of the little pieces is that romantic obsession, the falling in love experience, lasts on average 2 years. Okay? So you're steeped in this. You're steeped in this for 2 years, and this is the kind of love that has a way of not allowing you to see the road. And when you're falling in love, it ain't the fall that kills you. It's that day when you wake up and you realize that this person really annoys you. When you start dating, doesn't talk at all. It's like, that's okay, I can carry the conversation. It's very comfortable. It's very comfortable. It's like, do you have a good... I had a great time. I got to talk the whole time. There comes a point where it's like, will he ever shut up? And on the other side, you know, is she going to say anything? Does she have anything to say? And obviously, you know, we work through those points. Hopefully it's not that extreme. Initially it is a lot of times. But the thing is that if you're riding on the affection, that's not what's deep and abiding. Affection comes and goes. You can love somebody 1 minute, and you can't stand them the next. Affection. That's a reflection of affection in regards to the inner workings of the relationship. That's why it is so crucial to have duty love. I've heard agape referred to as God-type love. God is the author of all love. So to ascribe one to God and not, what I can say is there any more dutiful than God? Is there any more faithful than God? Absolutely not. Can anyone demonstrate affection for his creation like God, though? It's so important to have them both. And there's a couple of passages that I'd like to look at which demonstrate these differences. The first one I'd like to look at is in 1 Peter chapter 1. And verse 22. And whenever you get home, I suggest you pull out the Strongs on me and check me to make sure I'm telling you the truth here. In 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 22. Peter's writing to the believing readers here. Since you have in obedience to the truth purified your souls for a sincere love, agape. This is the duty love. So he's making the observation, you have in obedience to the truth, you have dutifully accepted in obedience the truth. You have a sincere love of the brethren, agape. So you know it's the right thing to do. You know it's the right thing to do to love the brethren. Knowing that, affectionately love them, phileo. Fervently love one another from the heart. For you have been born again, not of seed which is perishable, but imperishable. That is, through the living and abiding Word of God. The reason why he gives this imperative is that we're to love everyone, aren't we? Jesus has given us the imperative to love everyone. What is that? What type of love is that, though? Duty love. For God so dutifully loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. Did he have warm fuzzies for the world? God doesn't have warm fuzzies for the world, but he does have for believers in his Son. I'd like to turn to John chapter 16. This is the only place in Scripture that I'm aware of where it is said that the Father has affection for man. John chapter 16 and verse 27. This is Jesus talking to his disciples. And this is what he says here. The Father himself phileos you. The Father himself has affection for you. Why? And this is the condition. This is the conditional type love. This is unconditional type love. The condition of this love, because you have loved me and have believed that I came forth from the Father. In our marriage relationships, it is so critical that if this were a convection, we'd want the duty to be the flower and we'd want the affection to be the salt. You need a whole lot more duty than you do affection. Because affection's easy. You know, if warm fuzzies are flying all over the place, that's easy. But if things are tough, difficult decisions are trying to be made, there are stresses in our lives that are tearing at the relationship, we need to have a healthy dose of duty. And that is what we promise, isn't it? In sickness and in health, good times and bad, richer or poorer. Finally here, perceiving our roles correctly. I need to make sure that I'm not overrunning my visual aids here. The issue of submission is an issue that a lot of times gets glossed over, especially these days. I'll tell you right up front, I have the three people in the chain of command above me are all women. I've probably worked for more women than for men as far as intelligence, as far as good decision-making capabilities, as far as nurturing me as a worker to do well and to do better. I would much rather work for a woman in the workplace. I would. I know that this is apart from the marriage relationship, however. So we can have our opinions about that. I'm just voicing my opinion on that. All right? What I'm trying to express as well is that I have nothing against women in proper places of authority. None whatsoever. My best bosses have been women. But in this relationship, it can cause problems. And I'd like to turn to Genesis chapter 3 here. And this is a passage that I'm not sure, for a long time I don't believe I understood it correctly. I believe I understand it correctly now, and if I don't, express your opinion. But in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 16, we have the curse given to the woman at the fall of man. In addition to greatly multiplying the pain in childbirth, your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. Now, I've heard that explained, your desire shall be for your husband, that women will generally want to be with a man. That women will generally want to, they desire their husband, they desire to have a man. And I don't think that, taken on the face of it, that that's exactly what is being expressed here. Again, I've had it explained to me that there's one other place that this verbiage is used in the Hebrew, and it's just another chapter over here in chapter 4 and in verse 7. And this is where Cain has been displeased at God's displeasure at the lackings in his offering. And God says to Cain, "If you do well, will not your countenance be lifted up? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is for you." Sin was at the door, and it wanted to take Cain from his place. Wanted to take him away from the presence of God, which is what ultimately wound up happening, is that he wound up becoming a vagrant and a wanderer on the face of the earth, because he allowed sin to overtake him. This is the same verbiage back in the prior chapter, is that there's going to be this tension in the relationship where oftentimes the wife may have difficulty with this Pandora's box that was unleashed as far as having difficulty in submission. You can't do it by yourself. We can't do any of this thing by ourselves. We have to submit ourselves first to God. In Ephesians chapter 5, verse 21, just before we start seeing the likeness of Christ and His church in the shadow of husband and wife, Paul writes to the Ephesians, submit yourselves one to another out of what? Out of the other one being worthy of it? The other one making it easy for you to do so? Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. Again, what is this marriage thing? This marriage thing is a representation of Christ and His church. Nothing less, nothing more, and nothing else. And if we are believers in Jesus Christ, we have to follow through in our behavior to that end. That husbands are reflective of the husband of Christ, and wives are reflective of the husband of the church. The issue of submission. I'm not trying to hawk George Stephanopoulos' political memoirs, All Too Human, A Political Education. What I did find interesting about this was on the back of the dust jacket. And what I found on the back of the dust jacket is a White House file photo. And when you look at this White House file photo, you see two men in the back of a limousine. One of them is the President of the United States, who is not talking. He's reading. Over here, you've got George Stephanopoulos, who is not the President of the United States. And he's talking. And this man who is the President of the United States is listening. And I looked at that. I said, that's an interesting picture of submission. Who's the boss? Air quotes. What's that? Perhaps. Here's the thing. People think that being in places, positions of authority is a great thing. If you had to live one day in the President of the United States' shoes, the thing that a lot of people don't realize, well, they think he's the ruler of the free world. The thing is that he's told where to go, when to be there, how to do it. And if you're a husband that is following after Jesus Christ, you better be that way. Got a lot of reading. Got a lot of listening. 1 Peter chapter 3. Verse 7. You husbands likewise live with your wives in an understanding way. How many here of you guys are experts on women? No takers. How are you going to live with your wife in an understanding way, but what she can't be free to tell you what you need to know? Seriously. I'm worse than clueless, even when I do hear it. But without having that humility that Jesus demonstrated. Further, living with your wives in an understanding way as with a weaker vessel, since she is a woman, and grant her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life, so that your praise may not be hindered. This is a Casey's mug for those of you who can't see the Casey's emblem. Figured I'd do that for you all here in Central Iowa. But what I see here is a husband. Husband can take some knocks. Inside is the wife. Weaker, perhaps. I know some strong women, but the fact of the matter is that the weaker things in this world are oftentimes the more precious. As in this case. As in the case of Jesus dying for His church. That Jesus took the abuse for His bride. That's the kind of heart
husbands need to have if it is to be mirroring Jesus. And if we really want to see this thing through to death, we've got to be serious about following our Master. We've got to be serious about following Jesus. I want to close with a story that I first read in a non-Western lit class in my mid-20s. You always wonder when you're taking those classes what you're going to take away, because it's just a lot of strange, weird stuff a lot of times. And please forgive the title. The title is The Ten Cow Bride. In a village in the heart of Africa lived a very wealthy king with six lovely daughters and one very plain, some would say ugly, daughter. Now this wise king knew the value of daughters, and when it was time for them to be married, according to their tradition, a lobola, or wedding gift, was to be presented to the king before any marriage proposal. Now the pretty daughters were chosen and were married as soon as they came of age. The plain daughter matured, and when it was her turn to be married, there was no suitor in sight. The villagers were not kind, as they snickered about who might be the unfortunate candidate to have to marry the most homely of the king's daughters. But the king was a kind father, and he decided to seek a husband for his daughter, because he was concerned about her unhappiness and despair. He approached the prince of a neighboring village and tried to strike a compromise by saying that the lowest of lobola would be most appropriate or acceptable. Unfortunately, the prince turned the king down. Distressed, the king offered a lower compromise, and still he was refused. Then the king offered no lobola, convinced that at least this would be accepted, and yet the prince refused, and the astonished king then asked if he was expected to pay to have this prince marry his daughter. The prince looked at the unhappy king, paused, and then asked the strangest of questions. How much was the highest lobola paid for one of your daughters? Sputtering, the king replied, 5 cows. The prince again paused, quietly looked into the eyes of the king, and said, I will pay 10 cows for the honor of marrying your daughter. The shocked king was hardly able to comprehend his good fortune, but quickly accepted and closed the deal. Hurrying back to his village, he happily spread the news of this most prosperous of events, and the villagers were astounded. The wedding celebration was a long and happy event. The prince and his bride left to go to their new home. And several months later, all the daughters gathered for a celebration, and as the plain daughter approached the gathering, everyone gasped. She had transformed into a glowing and beautiful woman. And throughout the celebration, she recounted how the prince had secretly been in love with her for years and was shocked when her father came to him first. He had been willing to pay the highest of lobola to show how much he valued and treasured her. He continued expressing his love for her, and she began to realize how precious she was to him. Gradually, she allowed his love to shine through her. The beauty that everyone could now see was a reflection of his love. Husbands, do you love your wives like that? Or are you just looking for the bargain basement of what you can get by with? Jesus didn't do that. The millions and arguably billions of bulls and goats that were offered for the sins of mankind could not pay the price for Christ's bride. And he was willing to go all the way. He was willing to sacrifice it all. And he did. We should be such good husbands. And we as wives should be so willing to allow our husband's love to be shown through. Jesus wants you to be part of his bride. Jesus wants you to be part of the believers. In one place, Jesus said, who is my mother and brothers?
He who does the will of my Father is my mother and brother and sister. What better definition of a wife is that? She is to me a mother nurturing a sister and a brother. And we, as been mentioned earlier, can be joint heirs with Jesus Christ if we allow ourselves to be married through the sacrifice He offered for your soul. If you have not availed yourself of the opportunity of becoming Christ's bride, part of Christ's bride, we encourage you to do so as we stand and sing the final number.